I still see some plumb lines there. You know what you're missing if you don't have that plumb line paper. I mentioned this the other day, and I'll say it again. We're going now into over 40 different states, including Alaska and Hawaii and some foreign countries, and we just started that little old thing to work right around the perimeter of Nashville, Middle Tennessee. But it has surprised us by the help of various people. And I want to encourage you to take the plumb line. And you brethren are out here in this part of the world, send us some good brief scriptural articles. I read the other day in the Gospel Advocate where they said they receive 500 articles per year for the Gospel Advocate. And I get a few for the plumb line to print. And some of those, I can't print them, I'll be honest. We received an article the other day from a man. The second one he sent, I haven't printed either one. And I just took the time with my red pencil and made notations. He had 140 some odd errors in that one little article. And that's the day I had some time to do some things. But I don't have time to spend rewriting an entire article. I don't know if anybody does. 140 some articles. I wrote him a letter, very kind letter, nice letter, and I told him to get him a grammar book and study that grammar book, which I do myself. I have a grammar book on my desk, and study that and be able to become a little more proficient and efficient in writing, and don't give up, just keep on trying. And that's the way that you can improve, and I can improve. Now, on Monday, we began Perspectives on the Development of Liberalism in Churches of Christ, or in the Church of Christ. I have written a book, been on that thing for over 2 years, dealing with this, researching this. Got about that much material that I've written, and we're going to put that into the hands of the printer in just a short time, because I want our young preacher boys to know something about the stream that has filtered down through the years, and then be able to show exactly where our liberal brethren are getting their information and their material. I think all members of the church need to know that, and to see the cesspool from which brethren are now lapping and presenting this thing to young preachers, particularly, who go out into congregations, infiltrating them, and of course, destroying the church with that kind of foolishness. And so if you were not here, we began with Spinoza. You've got to begin somewhere, and so he was where we began. We began with Spinoza, and from there we moved on. We talked about five of those individuals. I think we completed with old Tom Paine, Spinoza, Voltaire, Kant, and Paine, and so on. And then we took up some theologians in Germany, particularly Schleiermacher, and then went on, you know, Wellhausen, his documentary Hypotheses, and Bauer and Strauss, and others. I think we mentioned 10 of those, and I'm pushed for time today. But at least we tried to survey the scene. And today I want to move on just a little bit and come to America. If you'll study a little bit in your history, you'll know that the universities up in the Northeast had been established. There was Yale, Princeton, Harvard, and Andover. Andover's now become Andover Newton. These theological schools had been started. But all of those professors who were talking and speaking and teaching in those universities, they had to go to Germany in order to get their education. And so they would go to Germany and they'd study under Bauer in his Tübingen school, and they'd go to Halle, and they'd go to Marburg, and they'd go to Heidelberg, and they'd go to Berlin, and they would come back. And they were just sodded, or besotted and saturated with modernism.
And they would sit in the classroom, and there they would belch this fermented ignorance out to their students. And we would have brethren who would go over to those schools and get filled with that modernism. And then they, of course, would begin to teach that sort of stuff. Alexander Campbell, by the way, or Thomas Campbell, came over to this country, as you perhaps well know if you study history very much, in 1807. In 1809, Alexander's son came over. Alexander had been educated in the University of Glasgow, and he taught school in Scotland for a little while before he came over here. But when he hit the shores of America, he was full of energy and vitality. And so immediately he began to work. And it wasn't long till he established a paper which was called the Christian Baptist, 1823. Campbell was exceedingly tough. He was full of satire. He was running over with sarcasm. And he utilized this at length in his writings. Had a lot of criticism. Someone has well said, I think, and he told the truth, that when Campbell looked out upon the religious scene of his day, and he was well aware of all of the gross ignorance which prevailed in the religious realm in America at that time. And you remember that that was a time when Calvinism was rampant. And all sorts of tales were being told by people who had a religious experience and how they were called to preach. And I remember one person gave his experience. He dreamed that he was a little chicken down on the ground, and here was this hawk up here waving up above him, and the hawk divin, and there ain't no such word as div, but that hawk divin him, and that little chicken ran under a brush pile, and that was his experience. He was saved, Brother Brown. Salvation. Well, it was a dream, but Campbell was fed up with that kind of stuff. That's why he was so tough in the old Christian Baptist. Well, he decided he would quit the Christian Baptist, which he did, and he started the Millennial Harbinger in about 1830. And through these papers, he had a tremendous amount of influence in his day, and then in a short time, he started Bethany College, 1841. Campbell did a great work. He made a lot of mistakes. Of course, he wasn't an angel. But in the era in which he lived, the time period, he did a lot of good. I've never decided I wanted to follow Alexander Campbell, or any other kind of a Campbell for that matter. We do not subscribe merely to the writings of men, nor are we subservient to men. But Campbell meant well. And I think in that respect, I'm like Campbell, and that may be the only one. I mean well. I mean well. Brother Choate may not agree with that, but I mean well. But at any rate, here is this college at Bethany, Bethany College. And it wasn't but a little while until a man came in who had been schooled, educated over the University of Virginia. Now, where do you reckon the professors of the University of Virginia had been? Well, they had been up there to the northeast, and they had gotten them some learning. Oh, they were smart. You don't have to read three or four books. You can really get smart nowadays. And so they got real smart, and they educated this young fella. He became the son-in-law of Alexander Campbell, W.K. Pendleton. In fact, he was Campbell's son-in-law twice. First wife died, married Campbell's daughter, another daughter. W.K. Pendleton came into Bethany College, and immediately it began to be saturated with modernism, liberalism, one of the schools. And I want to lay some emphasis and stress upon this thing. He became, first of all, the vice president of the college there at Bethany. And then later on, he became the president of Bethany. And in a short time, he became the editor of the Millennial Harbinger. And you can read those old Millennial Harbingers. And to show you how brilliant W.K. Pendleton was, and I'm not disparaging the man, but listen to this. There are some duties of the church which a single congregation cannot, by her unaided strength, discharge. Now, that doesn't even make good nonsense when you stop and think about it. Here's a congregation that has some duties, but that congregation cannot dispense with its duties by itself alone. Look, there are only two things a congregation is supposed to do, right? One is work, and the other one is worship. Now, what else does a congregation have to do? Not a solitary thing. Work and worship. But you can't do that. You have some duties that you can't do by your unaided strength. So you got to have some help. You see, what he's doing is plowing a furrow where the missionary society will be set in just a little while. Pendleton became a staff writer for the old liberal digressive Christian Standard. And he wrote that the pious unimmersed ought to be allowed to commune. In latter years, somebody was dealing with this thing, and they asked old Brother Shrigley what he thought about the pious unimmersed. Brother Shrigley said he wasn't interested in the pious unimmersed. He was interested in the pious unbelievers. And that was getting back to the root of the situation. It is interesting that Pendleton was joined by Robert Richardson there in the school at Bethany. Robert Richardson had the idea, and we've already seen a little bit about Pendleton, but Richardson said we can know God through nature. Now, those of you who were here on Monday will remember that natural religion was one of the things that developed in Germany, particularly, well, back with those theologians, into the old philosophers. They believed and taught this sort of thing. So here is Richardson, a professor at Bethany, along with W.K. Pendleton. And you can imagine those young boys in that school going out and teaching natural theology. Natural theology. Well, moving along rather quickly, in 1844, you have the first general convention of the disciples up in Virginia. You say, "My, that's pretty fast." Yes, it is pretty quickly. But you know something, brethren? The devil doesn't take always to accomplish what he wants to accomplish. Isn't it the case that sometimes truth is as slow as a tortoise? Is that, it's a turtle, terrapin. Getting in places. And error is as swift as the bounding stag. It is. In 1845, the American Christian Bible Society was started by these liberal brethren. In 1849, very, very peak point in history, the American Christian Missionary Society began in Cincinnati, Ohio. In 1850, the Kentucky State Missionary Society started. 1852, the Ohio Christian Missionary Society started. And I'm just mentioning a few of these to show you, bang, 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 bang. That's the way those things began. I mean, immediately. Immediately. And you wonder, how in the name of reason could things develop this fast? Well, there was a lot of problems, a lot of troubles developed. Controversy developed over this sort of thing. 1849, the Missionary Society. 1851, the infamous box was moved in at Midway, Kentucky. They first started out with that thing down in the basement, and they said they used it in order to help their singing. And they said the singing was so bad, when they'd start, the rats would run out from under the house. Well, that's still no excuse for bringing the thing in, but nonetheless, they finally moved it up from the basement into the auditorium. Up in Lebanon, Tennessee. Lebanon is the county seat of the county where I live. And the College Street congregation has had a piano in the basement for a number of years. And the young folks, and I don't know where the old ones do or not, but I do know that's where they go, and they'll do the clock, and they'll do this, and they'll do that. Let me tell you something, it isn't but just a little distance from the basement up to the auditorium. You wait till these old characters die up there and get out of the way, I'll guarantee you. Well, they might as well have it up there now, because it's just a bunch of liberal wackos anyway in that congregation, and that's the truth. They have Ruba Shelley up there. They might as well move the piano in, get it out of the basement, and take the sign down. Might as well do that. But let me just drop this point by way of passing. I went back and I tried to dig up all of the arguments that have been made in the interest and in the behalf of instrumental music after they brought that thing in. First of all, they said it is an expedient. It's just an expedient. Then along came O.E. Payne with his book on solo, and he declared, you've got to have instrumental music. It's not even an expedient. You must have it. The instrument inheres within the word solo. You've got to have it. Well, Brother M.C. Kerfey's answered Payne quite well. Brother Guy Woods gave me a copy, his copy of M.C. Kerfey's book, Answering O.E. Payne, an old, old, old book. Well, it was first an expedient. Then you've got to have it. And then I looked up all of the propositions that have been debated, as many as I could find, and excuse me, sir, don't fence me in when I'm in Texas. But at any rate, they began to debate instrumental music in worship is scriptural. They put it in worship. And now you know what the liberals are saying? You know what the digressives are saying? The Christian church is saying? They say now it's not in the worship. They don't know what it is. They don't know where it is. And they couldn't make a sensible, cogent, intelligent argument for the use of instrumental music if their life depended upon it. And tell them I said it, Brother Brown. They have jumped around like kangaroos from one side of this thing, but that's liberalism for you. In 1857, Professor Richardson wrote a series of articles in Millennial Harbinger on German neology and French philosophy. What it was is French fool's philosophy. The word neology, by the way, just simply means neo is new. And it is the practice of taking words that are ordinarily used, easily understood, and giving them new meanings. Reinhold Niebuhr refers to that as bastardy language. And that's exactly what it is. I think he pegged it right. German neology, taking these words and giving brand new meanings to them. Well, we've got some brethren right down here at AI, whatever. Yeah. And they're doing the same thing. Take good words and give them new meanings. Go over to Nashville to the Christian Scholars Conference, and I bought all of those papers to read. And if you want to know the meaning of meaning, one of those young characters had the effrontery and the colossal gall to speak on the meaning of meaning. I imagine he's read 2.5 books somewhere in order to accomplish so much. It is absurd beyond belief. Well, Talbert Fanning and Jacob Kreth, Jr. opposed this kind of stuff. In 1857, Brother S.B. Giles wrote an article, and he said that there is some departure from gospel purity and relaxation in dedication to the brotherhood, I think requires but little sagacity to discover. Now, brethren, we're not far removed from where we began just a little bit ago. Here is a man telling us, writing, that there is a departure. There has been a removal from that point that we began back here. Well, that's what we're going to see now from now till the close of our lesson this morning, this evening. Ben Franklin was the editor of the American Christian Review. Ben Franklin began, he was favorable to the Missionary Society. But he eventually turned away and turned the influence of the review against the liberal viewpoint and modernism. Ben Franklin wrote, I thought this was rather interesting. He said, it is now wisely discovered that the terms of pardon laid down in the New Testament is advocated, propagated, and defended with such unprecedented success by the disciples for the last 30 years, as one man expressed it, quote, have rendered us ridiculous in the eyes of the world, and that we must go on to perfection. Why, you could pick that up in wineskins or some other kind of a skunk skin somewhere. And brethren saying the same thing. We're ridiculous in the eyes of those around us. We are ashamed to take our friends to us, with us, to that old congregation in Spring, Texas. They have that old traditional worship, you know. We're ashamed to take our friends, and that's quoting, with us now to worship. We've got to get contemporary. Well, I don't know too many words, but I know what contemporary means. If you sing in a little while, Rock of Ages cleft for me, let me hide myself in thee. We all sing it. I think that's contemporary, don't you? If we're singing it in a few minutes, that doesn't mean we sang it 100 years ago or we're going to sing it 100 years from now. It's contemporary. I'm contemporary right now standing here. Now, I may not be contemporary in a little while, but I am right now. Well, they talk about contemporary music. What you're talking about? A bunch of holy roller stuff. That's all it is. And I know what I'm talking about. And Brother Choate, I'm telling the truth today. This is the truth. Well, in 1861, old Isaac Arendt, you remember him. By the way, Doug Foster, down here, up here, wherever, over here somewhere, at Abilene, kind of a smatterer in history, and I say that advisedly, but he says that Isaac Arendt was a mediator between the far out left wing and the right wing back yonder, and Isaac Arendt was a mediator. Well, if Isaac Arendt was a mediator, I promise you that is what the devil is doing today. Isaac Arendt says, we're therefore compelled to recognize as Christians many who have been in error on baptism, but in the spirit of obedience are Christians indeed. Now, when was that written? 1861. What's this? 1996. I told you Monday, any absurd, far-out, ridiculous statement that our brethren are making today, this side of 1960, I promise you I can go back and I'll find you an old rationalist, an old modernist, some old infidel that made that same identical statement in days gone by. Well, the Christian standard with Arendt began in 1866. Isaac Arendt was the corresponding secretary of the National Missionary Society. Doesn't sound like a mediator to me. He helped start the Woman's Missionary Society, or the Women's Missionary Society. I don't think that's a mediator. He was the first president of the Foreign Christian Missionary Society. I don't believe that's a mediator, do you? And then, of course, he was the first editor of the Christian Standard. Now, I have all of the old Christian Standards from the very first issue when Isaac Arendt became the editor, right on down the line. And you read those old Christian Standards, if you can get a mediator out of Isaac Arendt, I can raise every dead person in the world. And I'll make you that proposition. He was no more a mediator than the devil. Well, let's go out here to Robert Richardson and W.K. Pendleton School at Bethany. And go down to Lexington, where Pinkerton, L.L. Pinkerton, was he was a professor there. You take those two at Bethany and this one at Lexington and Isaac Erritt as the editor of the Christian Standard, what do you have? What do you have, brethren? You have a tremendous influence being wielded in the various congregations of the Lord's church. And there wasn't a lot of resistance. One old brother said we made two mistakes. We did not start early enough marking the heretics. And when we did mark them, we did not avoid them. Are we listening? Isn't that our problem today? In 1855, Talbert Fanning and William Lipscomb started the Gospel Advocate. And Brother Fanning says in one of the early issues there, I determined to give the matter of cooperation a thorough, a complete coverage or investigation. There's trouble everywhere. Trouble in Nashville, Tennessee. Trouble up north. Trouble in the south. Trouble everywhere. And so these old brethren started the Gospel Advocate to try to stave off some of this problem. Brother Rice said last night, by the way, I've got to mention this, he was talking about contending for the faith, firm foundation, etc., etc. And he said, I came along with the plumb line as a kind of a Johnny's come lately. Well, that's all right. That's all right. I'd rather be a Johnny's come lately as no Johnny at all. And that's one of our problems. It really is. But I didn't start this paper till a year ago August. But that was not when I first began writing on liberalism and problems and difficulties in the church. I've written 30-some-odd books in order to deal with a lot of this tomfoolery in the church. A good Pearl Street church over here took one of those books when I answered Alvin Jennings on a critique of how Christianity grows in the city. I don't know, we printed 10,000 copies of that thing once. It went into two printings. I was trying to deal with that Crossroads Boston problem. They sent that book all over the world, I reckon. I don't know. But I begin to think, well, maybe just writing booklets is not enough. Maybe it's not enough. Maybe we need to start a little old paper around Nashville. And so lately we've done that. And we're going to keep on if the Lord spares us and we can do that. And I think it's having some effect. I really do, and I want you to pray for us in that effort. But that's a little bit off the subject. There was a thing that was developing over in Missouri. The Missouri Christian Lectureship. And I have some of the printed copies of those old lectures back there. And all in the world it was just modernism being spurted and spouted out by the speakers on that old lectureship. You turn to the Gospel Advocate in 1890... And every issue, just about it in that year, Brother Lipscomb and various others were writing on the subject of rationalism over in Missouri. 1890, it'll be worth your time to read those articles. And he generally wrote under the title is Rationalism Rife in Missouri. But R.C. Cave went over to St. Louis, Missouri, and he preached a sermon at Central Church. They wrote him up in the city newspaper. Because of his infidelity, he denied the inspiration of the Old Testament. He denied the inspiration of the New Testament. He said that the representations of God in the Old Testament were frightfully false. He said Jesus was not a divine person. Now that's modernism out there in Missouri. Alexander Proctor spoke on that lectureship. He said the idea of angels and demons is a mere superstition. imbibed from the heathen during the Babylonian exile, where the old polytheists saw gods of good and evil, and the Jews, angels and demons, we see scientific causes. That's modernism, naturalism, rationalism. He said all man has to do is to look within to know God. Well, that's, now we're talking about preachers in the Church of Christ. Modernism. And it's still flowing along. George W. Longan, one of those modernistic preachers at the lectureship, said Luke, the book of Luke, was fabricated by some unknown writer. The writer added whatever he wanted to add as he wrote. He said the account of the sun standing still as given in the Old Testament is, quote, a piece of foolishness. Well, that's what you get at in some of our Bible courses in some of our universities now. And that's back yonder around 1890, by the way. John wrote what he thought Jesus thought, but John had lapses of memory. Well, that's the way I write, you know. I have lapses of memory. I don't write what I thought Jesus thought, but I write what Jesus said. And that'll have some memory lapse. Matthew and Mark were mistaken about what Jesus taught. That's a preacher in the Church of Christ. The book of Luke is spurious because he wrote much later than the destruction of Jerusalem. John put down what he felt people would read. The best men of our time, that's the German and French theologians, have broken with human authority, meaning the Bible. They've broken with that. Paul was a false teacher. God gives account of himself to my poor understanding in a way that's perfectly satisfactory to me. Then another one, Professor Long, said there are two schools to choose from. One presents the revelation of God through a book. The other presents the revelation of God through science, art, literature, music. We look to science to see the thoughts of God. The more progressive minds break away from the old party and form a new one. That's what's happening now. Who was it asked if we had any community churches around this part? That's what they're doing up in Nashville. Break off. Start your new community church. Moving on. Paul was not inspired, as was Peter. No two men were inspired alike. Every man's inspiration is for himself and adapted for his own age. If you're very particular about Bible names for Bible things, you'll have to give up inspiration, you see. Well, so much for that. Old Brother Lard had written on this particular point, Moses E. Lard. And the way the modernists and the liberals dealt with the brethren who were answering them, they called them croakers. And they called them legalists. Legalists and legalism. Would you do me a favor? I'm serious. Would you give me a good, cogent, sensible, intelligent definition of legalism? Would you do that? I hear brethren talk about legalism and legalists. I began to hear this when I was a student at Vanderbilt Divinity School. They talked about legalism. Listen to this. Brother Millard said, the term legalism I do not like. It is an offensive term with a bad sense as popularly used and should therefore not be employed. Obedience to the commands of Christ is its exact equivalent and should always be used in its stead. But few men could be found bold enough to speak against the commandments of God. The results here would be glaring. None could fail to see and would pronounce it infidelity. A more insidious method is adopted. Legalism is the thing inveighed against, but the act amounts to the same. Legalism and obedience to the commands of Christ are the same. Hence, to speak against that is to speak against this. I have a little book here that I treasure, 1809 and 1909. It's the anniversary programs of the Christian Church, Disciples of Christ. And in that convention, they had women preachers. They had brass bands. You name it, they had it. That's how far away the movement, the efforts had gone. Let me get in overdrive. Now, the awakening. I've not talked too much about these other things. But anyway, the more respect and reverence a man has for a book, the less he has for God who made the book. I must change, modify, and amend my creed every day of my life. That came from one of those liberal newspapers. Well, you see the stream now as it flows. Brethren got fed up with that kind of foolishness. The digressive liberal Christian church stole every school, every one of them. They stole 6 out of every 7 congregations in the whole brotherhood. And I tell people that, and they blink sort of like hoot owls. Say, well, that won't ever happen here. Brethren, wake up. Some of you haven't heard me. Some of you haven't read history. Some of you don't know history. Some of you don't think it'll happen. Some of you think it can't happen. And if it couldn't happen, I wouldn't be here. I'd be sitting home in my happy chair, twiddling my thumbs like a lot of other preachers are doing. And I don't mean any disrespect. Talk about the awakening now. A militant spirit. I remember Brother B.C. Goodpasture said one time, the Church of Christ will never be victorious until it becomes the church militant.
Amen.
I like that. I need that. Out in Texas, there was a man by the name of Clark Braden who eventually moved forward and was willing to debate the matter of instrumental music in worship. I read that in the old Firm Foundation, in 1898 issue. Clark Braden met Brother Joe Warlick. And then in Henderson, Tennessee, Carol Stark met Brother Joe Warlick in debate. My, they learned in a hurry. In 1926, Brother H. Leo Bowles met M.D. Club in a written debate. And then Brother Hardiman, N.B. Hardiman, in 1933, met Ira Boswell in a debate. And that just about put the digressives to sleep. So far as instrumental music was, they didn't want to debate him. But John D. Cowden, by the way, John B. Cowden, wrote G.C. Brewer a letter. And he said, now you young preachers are the ones that caused all the trouble. Well, that's not the case. Well, we had a few schools to be started then. Freed Hardeman, Abilene, Lipscomb, Harding, those sort of things. And you know something? For a little while, they were the citadels of truth. And I'm going to say this. Today, those citadels of truth in some areas have become troughs full of corruption. And I hate to say that. Now, by the 60s, I think Brother Choate is supposed to take up here, dark, dark clouds began to loom on the horizon. Young men went to school, they finished, they got their baccalaureates, and they went on to some other eats. And they sat at the feet of infidel professors, and they swallowed that up like little puppies drinking warm milk. And then they came back into the schools, and the students sat there, and they lapped up that modernism and that liberalism. The professors inoculated the students. The preachers crept out into congregations and infested the congregations, and congregations are departing from the faith. And I'll close with this. What can I do? What can I do? I was intending to get an envelope and hold it up. An envelope. Maybe I can't do much, but you know how much an envelope costs. And then I intended to bring a stamp with me. They've already licked the stamp for you. Now, you don't even have to waste spit, brethren. And I'm serious. I'm serious.
You can get you an envelope. You can get you a stamp that's already whatever the stuff, glued. Yeah. And you know how much a pencil will cost? How much a pencil will cost you? Well, we gave Brother Choate one last night. It will cost you hardly anything. But just an envelope and a stamp and a pencil won't get the job done. Some way, somehow, you got to pick up his arm. Oh, it's so limp. How much time I got? Finish this. You got to pick up his arm if you're not already dead. And you got to write just a little bit. And I wonder what 1,000 letters on Royce Money's desk in the morning would do. It would do the same thing it would do if it was on my desk.